Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I remember when I was a Cub reporter quite a while ago interviewing my first Iditarod rookie who believed he had a shot at the money. I kind of believed too because he did. Now I've seen too many rookies come and go, and I know, along with a lot of mushing fans, that making it to the top of the sport takes many years, many, many hours of training, and the endless work of producing perfect dogs. On today's show, we're going to ask what it takes to become an Iditarod musher, not by talking to the stars, but with a conversation with some rookies, some dog handlers working in kennels, and getting down and dirty into the real work. It's the Iditarod for the rest of us on today's Outdoor Explorer, and I have three guests who are really perfectly chosen to be an expert panel on this topic because dog mushing is their life, but they're also not the household names that we hear from all the time. On the phone with us from Willow is Christian Turner, who is a handler with the CV Kennel, and he finished the Iditarod in 2014, and in this year's race, he is hoping to have a much better finish. Thanks for being with us, Christian.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
And Liz Millman is in the studio, and she's a handler with Dee Dee John Rose team with her kennel, and was up a lot. Christian and Liz sound like they're both up in the middle of the night, so we're really glad to have them here. And we're pre-recording today's show because the Iditarod's upon us, so we pre-recorded it well in advance. Thanks for being with us, Liz.
Yeah, thank you.
And you came in from
Willow.
From Willow, yeah. And then Philip Walters is in the studio, and he is going to run the Iditarod for the first time this year, 2015, and a Begich Middle School band teacher, and also amateur musher. And you must like shepherding around recalcitrant teenagers, because it seems like you do it for your hobby and for your work.
They're very similar, yes.
Yeah. So tell me, Philip, how did you get into dog mushing? It's such a big step, right? It's a lifestyle, all consuming.
Well, the step is big when you look back at it, but it seemed pretty logical at the time. I just started getting involved with local races out in Chugiak. I had fallen in love with dog mushing just by reading about it when I first moved up to Alaska back in 2005, and I was looking for a way to get into the sport, and met a local musher who said, "Hey, come out to the races at Chugiak, and we'll get you introduced to everybody and see if anybody's looking for some help." And I met Kurt and Val Jokola, who are out in Chugiak, and they needed some help with their kennel, and they, in exchange, let me run their dogs and use their equipment. And so I was working with them for a couple years, just kind of learning the ropes. And since then, I've kind of moved on to other kennels, and now I'm actually running out in Willow with Justin and Rebecca Savitas of Snowhook Kennel.
Do you remember the first time you got on the runners and the team took off, the first time you drove a team?
It was one of the coolest experiences I've ever seen, and looking back at it now, it was a three-dog team. It was actually the first time I was out by myself was on a three-dog team. The first time I was actually out on a dog sled was with a 12 or 14 dog team, and I was double sledding, which is when you have one sled behind another sled that's attached to the gang line with the dogs. It's used for a lot more control, especially for people who have never done this before. It's a very safe way of getting started, but there was so much power. People who aren't mushers think about the speed of the dogs, but it's more about how powerful those dogs are, and you just realize they're not going to stop.
Yeah.
The only way you can stop them is really if they want to stop, that's how you're going to stop them.
Yeah. I mean, it's this incredible thrill, right, of all that sort of canine muscle of just like flying down the trail. And anybody who's Alaskan who's not tried it has got to get out and just at least try it once.
Oh, it's a blast.
You can't really get it unless you've been on that sled.
Right.
So when did you decide you were going to try for the Iditarod? I mean, that's a huge, expensive, time-consuming goal that... I mean, that's just the race itself is the smallest part of it, right? I mean, that's a couple of weeks, but also just the getting ready and sort of all the preparatory races. When did you make that your goal?
I'm not really exactly sure. I've been running dogs for about 8 years now, and one thing led to another. I started with small recreational teams and kind of worked my way up, started doing smaller races like the Goose Bay 120 and the Don Bowers 200 and just smaller races that kind of everybody runs to get their dogs ready for bigger races, and we did pretty well, and it was kind of fun. And so I kind of joke around that Iditarod's the next logical step, but there's really nothing logical about Iditarod. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, who wants to go out in the freezing cold and go through crazy terrain like the Dalzell Gorge and the Farewell Burn and spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to do it? But there are at least, I don't know how many mushers are signed up this year, but I think at least 73 mushers are signed up to do exactly that this year. So I don't know when it happened, but it just kind of happened over the last 8 years.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a life achievement that you can go back and say to your grandchildren that you ran the Iditarod and you finished it, if you do finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I've just often thought just seeing this circus across the wilderness of Alaska would be amazing as a musher.
That's really one of the things I'm looking forward to the most, is just seeing new trails, seeing the terrain out there, being with the dogs for 10 days straight. I mean, there's all this work that goes into the race. But really, we do this because we want to be with the dogs. We love being out there where it's just us and the dogs, and it's silent. And sometimes if you're lucky, you've got a full moon and you can turn your headlamp off and just run with just the light of the moon. And maybe if you're really lucky, the northern lights are out and you can see those dancing across the sky. And it's just probably the most amazing experience you'll ever be a part of.
Yeah, yeah. So, Christian, you actually completed the Iditarod last year, sort of middle of the pack. Is that what it was like, what Philip was just talking about?
Yeah, that sounds a little bit more like a dream to me. I wish it was like that, dancing, the northern lights dancing across the sky. No, last year was pretty rough. There was no snow, so we all got pretty beaten up last year. But that's another reason why I want to do it again. I want to go on the trail with some snow. And last year you had top contenders dropping out from broken arms and legs and broken sleds. And to have a dream run is sort of, I think, what brings a lot of mushers back to the race. So maybe that's what's brought me back, to have a dream run.
So tell me about your race last year. You did make it to Nome, and you were kind of middle of the pack, right? I mean, you weren't right at the back for your first year, which is pretty good for a rookie.
I had a team that, yeah, they were young, but they were trained very similar to an A team, so they could have done better. But I had an extra 24-hour break in the burn when my sled crashed into a tree. So my sled hit a tree, and my gang line broke just after the wheel dogs. The wheel dogs are the two closest to the sled. The cable broke, and so 40 of my dogs decided to go towards Nikolai without me. So I ran after them, and it took me an extra 24 hours. They were sort of 2 miles down the trail, tangled in a tree. I caught them, and it took me overall 24 hours to do the run. Probably took me about 10 hours to get everything sorted. I had to ferry my sled back and forward. There are some photos. A journalist was in a helicopter. I thought he was there to help me, but apparently he was just taking some photos on me. But, so I sorted that out, and then that put me 24 hours behind the pack. But we regained our momentum, and we kept going. And, after that, I decided I just wanted to finish, like Philip said. The goal was to finish your first year, I think. I think being competitive, that's why I had trouble. But also the lack of snow just really beat a lot of people up and a lot of sleds up.
It kind of sounds like a nightmare to be out there in the woods, have your sled broken and your dogs loose, and be wandering around looking for dogs in the wilderness. I mean, it doesn't sound like much fun.
Yeah, it wasn't much fun at all. I was like, really? This happened on my rookie year? But when I saw the helicopter, it just perked me up. I'm like, sweet, someone's here to help. Because I was worried about the dogs. I didn't care about the race at that stage. I was like, my dogs are somewhere. I don't know if they're still on the trail. And I'm running in my full winter gear, so I'm starting to sweat. And it wasn't that cold, but if you sweat enough, it gets cold.
Mm-hmm.
So I stripped everything off, and yeah. I regained the dogs, got the sled back together. Did some maintenance, replaced the brake, and one of my stanchions was broken as well. And I sort of just limped it back into Nikolai. And I hadn't decided whether I was going to scratch or not after the big 24. I knew I was in a very bad position to be competitive. But I received a note from Dallas written on a bit of toilet paper saying, I know you're in trouble. There's a sled at McGrath waiting. So I was like, well, I can make it to McGrath. It's just
sweet.
A short, like, 50-mile run on the river.
That must have been the best piece of toilet paper you ever picked up, right? I mean, it's...
Well, I had to laugh. I looked at him like, is he kidding? Couldn't he find some paper somewhere? Like, what?
It's probably in a bit of a rush, right? So what's it like working with Dallas Seavey? I've interviewed him, and he's an interesting guy. He's so full of energy, and he's so full of drive, and so much strategy. I mean, he's like the most strategic musher out there, right?
Yeah, he likes to think so. But yeah, I guess there's some really good mushers out there. He being one of them, obviously, in the last few years. But yeah, we spend a lot of time poring over miles charts, poring over the race strategy of other mushers. But really, I don't know. It's how dedicated he is. He's always out there training. So am I. And he's always out there with his dogs. Like, he has his core team, and we just work with them. He's doing his massages as well as me. It's not like he has a core fleet of people that does all his work. He's right in there doing it, especially in winter.
So do you make a living doing this? I mean, I don't, you know, you don't have to tell me what's on your W-2, but it seems like, you know, mushers would not be able to afford to really employ large groups of people. Are you sort of getting your compensation of getting to mush and getting to live that lifestyle, or do you really make a living doing this?
I don't get paid for the 6 months I'm here. I get, like, you know, housing and internet and stuff like that. But because of the deal I have, it's a different sort of deal. A lot of handlers are different, but I've got a pretty nice deal. I'm pretty good friends with Dallas. I've worked with him for a few years. So he hooks me up with the best dog team he can, and I run it the best way I can, and I help him train it. And maybe those dogs will graduate to his team, and that's really why he likes having me here, because I'm able to train them at a high enough level that they may go into his team.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't want to stay up all week without sleep.
but that's what you get to do. Lucky you.
Yeah, it's great. Like, I love being cold and wet and tired. I don't know why.
Well, you're certainly going to have some amazing skills and some amazing memories. It's Outdoor Explorer. My name is Charles Wolforth. We're talking about making the musher, creating a dog team, getting a dog team on the trail, sort of the base of the pyramid rather than the tip of the pyramid of Iditarod winners we normally talk about. And so we're talking to a couple of rookie mushers. Christian Turner, we just talked to, wasn't a total rookie because he ran the race in 2014, but he's still considers himself in that category. And Philip Walters, who's going to run the race for the first time this year. And Liz Millman is with us. She's a handler with Didi Jonro's kennel, and Didi is probably the most popular, most beloved of our mushers. How did you haven't been there that long, right, Liz? I mean, you're kind of the really new to this whole thing.
Yeah, this is my second season working for her.
Uh-huh. And how did you, it was sort of a matter of chance that you dropped into this?
Yeah, basically I had a friend that got the job last year, and there was two handlers at her kennel, and one kind of quit and disappeared, and they couldn't find someone to replace him, and all of a sudden I got a phone call and was asked, hey, what are you doing with your life? Want to move to Alaska? And I'm like, why not? And wow. 10 days later, I was in Alaska.
And where were you?
Wisconsin.
Okay, so you're used to snow.
Yeah, I grew up ski racing. And
uh-huh. And, I mean, had you spent times around kennels with large numbers of dogs before, or was that all new to you?
I've had 24 dogs.
Really?
So I've had dogs my whole life, and sled dogs have always been a passion of mine since second grade when I learned about them.
Uh-huh.
So getting the job, getting the phone call was dream come true to come out and work with the dogs, and not only with the dogs, but for Didi Jonro was pretty amazing.
So you already knew about her and you're a fan.
Yeah, definitely.
So tell me, like, what's the first day on the job like? I mean, when you get to Alaska and you're suddenly in this dog yard, and you kind of prove yourself.
Yeah, my first day of work last year was negative 35 degrees, coldest I've ever been in.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, bright and early. It was actually not too early, 8 o'clock in the morning, up. And it was just getting the routine down, feeding, scooping poop, and learning where everything was, trying to learn 60 dog names within a week, and just kind of seeing how she runs her kennel. And I know how to take care of dogs and what they do, but, man, there's so much more involved in nutrition and health-wise of these animals that it's blown me away. It's been a very big learning experience.
Yeah, and I want to get into all of that later in the show about just how you run these huge kennels and all the work that's involved. But I'm still interested in sort of as we were talking with Christian and Philip, like, what are your goals in this? Where do you want to be, like a Didi Jonro up in the front of the pack someday?
Maybe someday. My first goal has always been to be a veterinarian on the trail working with sled dogs. It's what I've wanted since I was 7 years old. So I'm actually waiting to hear back from the University of Fairbanks for their vet program they just started. Hopefully start next year in vet school.
Uh-huh. So that would be a great job, right? But I mean, most of those guys, they're not like, they have a vet practice somewhere and they go out and just help out during the race, yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But there must be a lot of vets who take care of sled dogs in Alaska.
Oh, yeah, lots everywhere. And there's actually a need for veterinarians in the state. So there's a lot of opportunity, not just with sled dogs, but wildlife and everything else.
Uh-huh. Now, it sounds like you have more of a job than what Christian has, which is more of sort of unpaid partnership, you might say. How does that work for you in terms of it being a job?
Well, I get paid.
But probably the hourly rate would work out to, I mean, if you're...
I don't want to work it out to an hourly
rate.
No, it works. It's housing and internet and moose that I can eat.
Uh-huh.
But I get enough to cover my bills and student loans and buy groceries. But really, it's the experience. I mean, I'm learning. I help train some of the A team and the puppy team. And then... You know, it's just learning all the experience for veterinary school, all the medical stuff is really what makes it worth it for me.
Uh-huh. So how many hours are you, I mean, you said you were up really late last night driving a team, as was Christian. So I appreciate you guys coming in. But I mean, what's your typical day like in terms of number of hours?
The past couple weeks, we've been putting in about 10-hour days,
uh-huh.
6 days a week.
A lot of that at night.
Give or take, it changes every single day at our kennel. There's a lot of other things going on all the time, so we are extremely flexible, which is beneficial to the dogs, because when they're racing, there's no set schedule of this is when you eat every day or anything, so it's kind of nice that we keep it mixed up and change the routine often.
Mm-hmm. And so why would you be up in the middle of the night and running the dogs? What's the point of that?
They have to get used to running at night. And all right. Eating at different times of day, and we're training new lead dogs and stuff, so we want to teach them how to run at night and be confident, and when we're busy the next day and we don't have time to run during the day, well, then we can pick it up at night and sleep a little less and still make everything the next day that we need to.
Yeah, so you're kind of creating the same situation that the dogs are going to encounter when they're in the race.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, I want to hear... I have so many more questions, but it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Walforth. We're talking about making the musher, and which includes making the dog team, and what dog lots are like, and what this lifestyle is like, because it's very all-consuming. And you realize that at the top of the sport, it's much more than just a musher and a kennel. It's also a whole bunch of other people working with that person, right? Yeah. Sort of, it's a team of people as well as a musher.
Oh, yeah. It's a whole team.
Yeah. I mean, that's why nobody ever enters the sport and goes right to the top. It takes a long time to build this whole thing up.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, Philip, after listening to Christian and Liz about the amount of hours that are spent and the fact that they're part of it, there's a team of dogs and then there's also a team of people who's running the dogs, and all of those people are working many hours. You're trying to do this and also work a day job. How does that work?
Well, I'll let you know what after the race is over. It's working out okay. It's actually working out in some cases better than I expected it would. This was kind of a plan that was hatched a couple years ago at the Gnome Finishers Banquet. I knew Justin and Rebecca from Justin Savitas from races that I'd raced with him before, and he knew how I cared for dogs, and he also knew that I was trying to find a team to run Iditarod, because I don't own my own dogs, and I at the time was running dogs with Alan Peck and Barbara Trost, and those dogs weren't going to be finishing Iditarod with me, and so he knew that I needed a team, and he said, well, I've got dogs, and I have more dogs than I can run by myself, and why don't you start training with me, and you can run my dogs, you can run my B team, which is basically his younger dogs and some of his Iditarod veterans that aren't keeping up the really competitive race pace anymore. And so we started putting this plan together, and well, here I am now. Basically, I'm going to be running dogs 4 or 5 days a week. I have been running dogs 4 or 5 days a week in addition to teaching full time at Begich.
So give me like a daily schedule for you. I mean, is there sleep in there somewhere? Is that you've got that scheduled in?
There's sleep in there sometimes. My wife would say that I still get more sleep than she does because we have an 11-month-old.
Well, that adds it. That simplifies matters, right?
Oh, yeah.
A baby around, right.
Yeah, but basically, I'll go out to the kennel a couple times a week during the week after school. I'll come home from school, change clothes, grab a bite to eat, get in the car, drive about an hour and a half north to Willow, where the dogs are located.
Wow.
And then usually get there, scoop poop, water the dogs so that they're hydrated for the run, and then go out for anywhere from a 2 to 4 hour run, come back, feed the dogs, scoop poop, get in the car, drive home, get into bed.
So what time are you getting home? Because I'm trying to add this up. That's like 7-8 hours have gone by. You haven't mentioned eating either, but I suppose you've thrown that in there
somewhere. Three Bears gets a lot of my business because they've got the pre-packaged stuff. But usually I'll get home around anywhere from 11 to 1 in the morning, and I'll crawl into bed and get back up at 6 o'clock the next morning and go back to school the next day. So, you know, I mean, one of my biggest fears with Iditarod, or the things that makes me nervous about Iditarod the most is actually the sleep deprivation, just because I don't function that well with little sleep, but I'm starting to get trained for that too, just out of necessity.
Yeah.
So, and then on the weekends are easy. I'll go out on Friday night, stay out there, run dogs Friday night, run dogs Saturday, run dogs Sunday, and then...
Well, what is it? I mean, I'm just realizing, okay, there is another team member here, which is your wife, who's home taking care of a baby. And you're never around.
Yeah, my wife is.
How does that
my
work?
Wife is an absolute saint. She has. I don't think she realized what she was getting herself into. First of all, when she married me, but she knew I was a musher at the time. I took my first sled run the same week I met my wife for the first time. So she's known me as long as I've been mushing. But I don't think she realized what she was getting herself into when she said, "Sure, you can do it."
Uh-huh.
But she's been amazing. Basically, she's had to take care of everything at home so that I can 100% concentrate on the race, because it really does take all of your focus. And even teaching, I try to be 100% focused on teaching when I'm teaching, 100% focused on mushing when I'm mushing, and then 100% focused on being home when I'm home, which is usually sleeping.
Right.
So it's very, very difficult for her. But she's been phenomenal. And I will never be able to express my gratitude for her for that.
But I mean, this is something, you can't sustain this indefinitely. I mean, the other two guests today are essentially professional mushers, you know, and they're devoting their time to it. But you're more of a recreational musher who's going for it. Right. I mean, you're not going to be able to do this for years and years.
Well, yeah. And so people ask me, so what about after this year? And I say, well, let me get through this year first. I don't see getting out of dogs anytime soon. There are some people that will come up and they'll train with a musher for a couple years and run Iditarod, and then their bucket list is checked off and they go on and do something else. That's not even close to how I operate. I love dogs. I want to be around dogs. I don't see myself not being around dogs after Iditarod is over. It's not really a bucket list thing for me, but it's also, I don't know what the next step is yet. Again, we're taking it one step at a time and seeing what happens after this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess you probably already also love music too. So
yeah.
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 Interesting. Wow. It just, you know, it's hard to get a grip on just what a challenge it is to do this for somebody who also has a job until you actually hear the schedule that they have to keep.
Well, one of the reasons that it works at all is because Justin and Rebecca have been so accommodating. Mm-hmm. I mean, Justin really does do the majority of the work around the kennel, and I help out when I can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the biggest thing right there is Justin is running his kennel and I'm helping out.
Yeah. Hey, Christian, give me a sense of how your day goes. You know, that you were up late last night mushing just like Liz was. What is your daily schedule like as you work there?
So Dallas runs, the way he makes his money is he runs a tour business, sled dog tours. The guests will come up from Anchorage, and obviously we have the same chores. We've got to scoop, poop, feed, do medications, all those things every kennel does. But between sort of 10 to 3, we do tours. I normally don't do the tours. I'll be building sleds or unless they need me. So we've got some tour guides that will do the tours and I'll help out a little bit. Then after they've finished, we'll feed again or we'll do a project, I don't know, whatever we need around the kennel.
So how many and people then, are working there, Christian? Sounds like quite a few.
There's three tour guides, me, Dallas, and then Noah Pereira, and he won the Junior Iditarod in 2013. So, yeah, he ran my qualifying team. When I qualified that year, he ran the team, the Junior Iditarod, and won, which is pretty cool because he beat Conway Seavey, Dallas's little brother.
So, I mean, it's a pretty good-sized business, really. I mean, there's a bunch of people working there and a lot of moving pieces, it sounds like.
Yeah, and once everything falls into place, and this season's been difficult without the snow, but once everything falls in place, half the dogs will go to Chugiak where they do the tours. So then the tour business stops up in Willow pretty much. Like, we do some tours, but, yeah, the majority is down in Chugiak. But so far we've had no snow down there, so we're still doing the whole business up here.
Right.
And me and Noah.
And just to make sure the listeners know, we're actually recording this show all the way back in December. Hopefully by the time the show's on the air in March, there'll be plenty of snow. But, yeah, it's been a tough fall and probably really hard to get off the ground.
Yeah, it has. But as you said, Dallas is, he likes to schedule things and plan everything. So he's got contingency plans. And so me and Noah last night, after all of that stuff's done, all of the tours are done, we go on a undisclosed amount of mile run. So, yeah, and that run may have taken 12 hours. And, yeah, and then we wake up, we get back at 6 o'clock in the morning, we feed dogs, and I go to bed for a few hours and get a phone call to talk to you guys.
Wow. So you're basically up running all night long.
Yeah, that's how we do it at the kennel. And we'll sleep in a little bit, and then me and Noah and Dallas will get back up, and we'll have a coffee, and we'll help out with the tours, and it just goes around in circles like that.
So there's really no time in the schedule I'm hearing for just being a regular person. You're just kind of always a musher.
Not for us, yeah. So it's funny. We have a running joke at the kennel that the tour guides get days off, and we're like, what's a day off? Because they're obviously employed. They have jobs, and they do have days off, and we just laugh at them because we just work.
For no money.
But we love it. Like, there's no, if we didn't want to do it, we wouldn't be doing it, you know?
Right. Well, you've got the opportunity to live this amazing lifestyle and to run the Iditarod without having to build your own team and all that stuff. So, I mean, that's the benefit. But it's still, what about the rest of the season? I mean, it's not at this pace all year, right?
It actually ramps up. Well, the miles ramp up, but then the breaks between the runs also get longer, you know what I mean? So right now we're really sort of building a team. And then once they're built, you start doing the bigger runs. Like, a lot of people will do mid-distance races to see what their dogs are made of. They'll do a 300-mile, or they'll do, I don't know, a series of runs that simulate a short race. Dallas generally doesn't do the shorter races. He'll just do a training run somewhere. So I'd normally just tag along behind him like a lost sheep. And then after that, hopefully they're built up enough to, you know, to go into the Iditarod. Other teams like Lance Mackey and Jack King this year will do the Yukon Quest, and they'll be able to reassess after that and say, okay, my team did really well on the Yukon Quest. I took it a little slower. I'm going to hit them as hard as I can on the Iditarod. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a fast team there. But, the runs get longer, so I won't sleep for, I don't know, 3 or 4 days at all, just a few cat naps. But then after that, I'll have a few more days off without running. I'm still doing the daily chores, but I just don't have to run at night because the dogs are resting. It's all about recuperating the dogs. It doesn't matter if I'm tired. It's about the dogs, not me.
Wow. So tell me what the setup is like there in terms of is everybody sort of in the same compound with where you sleep and where the dogs are kept and where you do the tours and everything else?
Yeah. So Dallas has got a little kennel up in Willow. He's got over 100 dogs. We've got like 37 puppies this year, so quite a few puppies. There's a large yurt him and his wife and his daughter Annie live in. And then there's a heated shop, and I live in the heated shop, which is pretty cool. I get to sleep above dogs and all that sort of stuff. But then there's also a little ways down the road, there's a big cabin where all the tour guides live. it's also where Noah lives, and so they did pay the rent there, and they all live in this big sort of lakeside cabin thing, and then every morning and every night they get to and from. But yeah, the compound, yeah, it's only got four of us where the kennel is, and that kennel backs on to the power lines, which is sort of like a main thoroughfare for mushers. We can just mush straight to these big power lines and head to Willow or head up towards Talkeetna. And we can also get to the Iditarod Trail from our kennel as well once the rivers freeze.
This is so interesting. You know, I never have really focused in on what it's like to be part of one of these training teams. And it's so big and it's so all consuming. It's really fascinating. And we're going to be talking a lot more about it in the second half of the show, finding out more about Dee Dee Junroe's setup as well. She's also got folks working for her and getting ready. And we're just hearing from Christian Turner, who's with the CV Kennel up in Willow. And Philip Walters is with us. He's a middle school teacher who is going to run the Iditarod for the first time this year. We're pre-recording the show because if we were trying to record these folks in March, they would all be way too busy to be on the air with us. And so all that coming up in the second half. But first, we're going to take a break. When you say the word Iditarod today, most people automatically think of the epic dog sled race or maybe Leonard Sepulveda's Serum Run. But the trail itself exists because it was an essential transportation link during the Gold Rush era. The story we're going to hear now comes to us from Alaska historian Laurel Downing Bill. She is the charismatic personality between Aunt Phil's Trunk, the book series, which seeks to bring Alaska's little-known history treasures to life. Here's Laurel reading from her second book on Blazing the Iditarod Trail.
Major Wilds P. Richardson headed the construction of the Iditarod Trail route. He ordered Walter Goodwin of the Alaska Road Commission to blaze a route from Seward through the Cook Inlet country and beyond to Nome. From January to April 1908, Goodwin and a three-man crew scouted and blazed a trail from Seward to Susitna, and then west through Rainy Pass, across the Kuskokwim Valley to the Innoko Mining District, which included Ophir, McGrath, and Takotna. They then angled the trail northwest across the marshy lowlands of the Innoko Valley and connected with the Yukon Trail at Caltag. This route became known as the Seward to Nome Mail Trail. In his report to Richardson, Goodwin concluded that the 900-plus mile proposed route would be feasible only if mines of value were developed that would attract additional traffic. Unbeknownst to Goodwin, two prospectors, John Beaton and William Dykeman, had penetrated that virgin territory. On Christmas Day 1908, the pair discovered gold along the Iditarod River, a tributary of the Innoko, in the area that soon would become the Iditarod Mining District. It's believed that Iditarod is what the early Athabascan Indians called their inland hunting ground, meaning the distant place. The miners changed the name to Iditarod when they founded the town near the gold discovery. Beaton and Dykeman told a steamboat crew about their find as they traveled to Takotna to record their claims. Word spread. Within a year, the last full-scale gold rush in American history boomed in an incredibly remote section of Alaska. The new town of Iditarod briefly became the largest town in Alaska, boasting more than 4,000 people and sporting newspapers, hotels, electricity, and telephone service. Summer steamships plied their way from the Bering Sea up the Yukon, Innoko, and Iditarod rivers and towns like Flat, Discovery, Otter, Willow Creek, and Dykeman sprang up. Goodwin was told to build a trail from Caltag to Susitna Station in winter 1910, along with a nine-man crew and several sled dog teams. Goodwin followed his 1908 Seward Nome route and added a loop from the main trail to Iditarod and Flat, which were the district's two principal towns. He also plotted roadhouses along the route about every 20 miles. He and his team reached Seward in February 1911, having made the first official trip along the 938-mile route that quickly became known as the Iditarod Trail. By 1913, an alternate trail to Nome left the trunk line at Ophir, headed north to Ruby, where mushers followed the Yukon Trail east to Fairbanks or west to Nome. The rush to Iditarod and Ruby between 1910 and 1912 set 10,000 stampeders in motion. Within two decades, $30 million worth of gold was dug from these gold fields.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. Outdoor Explorer, I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking to early career dog mushers, handlers, rookies, finding out what it takes to get into this sport, which is capped off by the Iditarod that's coming up shortly. We're pre-recording because mushers would be way too busy if we were recording live, and learning about this lifestyle. It's much more than a job. Philip Walters is in the studio. He's a handler who's running his first Iditarod this year and also a teacher here in Anchorage. Christian Turner is with us by phone. He's a handler at the CV Kennel. He ran his first Iditarod in 2014, running again this year. And in the studio also Liz Millman, who is a handler at Didi Genro's Kennel. Liz, you mentioned earlier that you kind of had an athletic life before you got into mushing. You've only been in Alaska for a little over a year, and you were an alpine skier and competitor, and so being very devoted to your sports is not new for you. It's something that you've done in the past and sort of grew up with as you were skiing. And so I think it's interesting to think about the fact that to be at a high competitive level, it almost has to be, whether it's mushing or skiing, it almost has to be all-consuming, doesn't it?
Yeah, it becomes a lifestyle. You eat, sleep, and breathe it.
Uh-huh. And how does that affect, how did that affect you as a young person in terms of what your social life was like or what other dimensions of your life?
It was tough growing up, being gone every weekend in the winters and traveling all the time and trying to keep straight A's to be able to do the races. But you really find out who good friends are. Through all that, you learn that lesson quick, the ones who stick with you while you're gone. And even being out here, moving 4,000 miles away from all those amazing friends, they're still, supportive and encouraging. And that's really beneficial growing up. But at the same time, you tend to miss out on a lot. Mm-hmm. You miss the parties or the gatherings or what's going on. You're out of the loop with the inside jokes. And, kind of tough growing up, but at the same time, you get stronger and you really learn what dedication and responsibility is all about. And I think that really benefited me more once I made it to college and decided that I didn't want to be a skier anymore in college and that I wanted to focus on my education, because that was my biggest goal in life, was what I wanted to do as a career. So it definitely rolled over into my education side of life. And
because you know how to work, right? You know what it means to really sit down and get stuff done and not goof off, because you've done it.
Yeah, it definitely taught me that if you want something, you have to put your all into it. And, sometimes that means making a lot of sacrifices, but when it comes down to it, it's worth it. And the end goal is what you always keep your eyes on, and every little step towards it is an accomplishment, and you learn to really appreciate those small steps towards it that makes the whole final goal even mm-hmm. better.
Now, it sounds like working for Didi Jonro in her kennel is pretty all-consuming in terms of the number of hours you're putting in and the where you're at and sort of what's all involved. Does it turn out that most of the people you know are involved in mushing, or is there any life? I mean, are you back to where you were with skiing that it, say, takes over everything?
Yeah, it really takes over everything. I have been able to, this summer when I was here, just basic care for dogs, feed, water, scoop. I was able to join a rugby team and actually develop a social life here in Alaska, which was really nice and has rolled over again. And but no, now it's really just meeting a lot of mushers, other handlers. And, you know, we're all in the same boat. We're all fully consumed in the sport that, you know, we get together maybe once a week for a movie night and get to hang out and trade stories of the work week or, you know, just little breaks like that. But being on the same boat with everyone around you makes it much more easy knowing that none of us have a social life. So the 5 minutes we get to say hi and talk is your break for the week.
You've got a built-in topic of conversation because all you're thinking yep. about is dogs anyway, right?
Yep. Well, how are your dogs doing? Oh, mine are great. What are you feeding them now? And all right, see you later.
And it almost seems like, you know, there's kind of a, and you guys can jump in on this too, Christian and Philip. It almost seems like as human beings who are being raised up in this sport, you're a little bit like the dogs that you've talked about, where you kind of go from the B team to the A team, sort of start as a puppy that doesn't know what's going on. And it sounds like, Liz, you're almost doing an apprenticeship to be, you want to be a dog vet, you want to be involved in the Iditarod. You're kind of paying your dues right now, right? And that's sort of what the dogs do a little bit, yeah?
That's basically, I mean, mushing really is an apprenticeship. I mean, I was just talking with Justin about this the other day. There really is no manual. I mean, there are all sorts of books written out there about mushing, about how Lance Mackey does it or how Mitch Seavey does it, but there's not really a standard, this is what you do. Most mushers are going to learn it either coming into the sport and just kind of figuring it out on their own, but most mushers are actually going to learn how to do it from another musher. So it really is quite an apprenticeship, and you start from the bottom. My first day in a kennel was, here's a shovel, here's a bucket, there's a yard full of poop, and after that, we'll go for a run.
You guys have brought that topic up many times, so I'm thinking that's like a big part of your life, is picking up dog poop.
Yes.
Well, it was funny when Liz was talking about the topics of conversation, almost every time somebody's going to bring up poop, just because poop is it really is what kind of indicates what's going on with each dog. So, mm-hmm. yeah, we talk about it a lot, and you deal with it a lot.
And you categorize it, and you use it to base off medical treatment.
How's their poop? Is it good? Yep. Is it solid? Is it runny? What is it?
Oh, yeah, nice. That's delightful. Christian, do you see that as well, that the human beings are developed along the way, the same the dogs are developed, sort of step by step through an apprenticeship to become mushers? It's not something you know how to do when you just first get to the dog lot.
Yeah, definitely. I came from a sprint racing background, so I knew how to sled. I knew how to stand on a sled, and I knew how to run dogs when I got to Dallas's kennel, but it was completely different the way he trains his dogs, the way you're running them. Obviously, you're running them at quite a slower pace. All those things I had to learn from him, and yeah, he was the teacher. And then it works the same way down, so he's got him at the top, me, and I guess I'm a college student, and then there's all the tour guides and the... They're not lesser, but they're just less, not as much experience as me. So mm-hmm. my job is to train them and get them up to scratch at the beginning of the season. So, yeah, it is an apprenticeship, but there's just so many levels at Dallas's kennel because there's so many of us wandering around the kennel.
Right, and to get to that top level where you are a famous musher, you've really gone through all these stages, and nobody steps into that. And Dallas obviously grew up, his father was already an Iditarod winner. He grew up as a musher. In a top kennel, so that's a big advantage to do it. It's almost to think to build it from scratch seems so daunting, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Definitely,
it does. He was lucky enough, as you said, to grow up with his dad. But his team he won in 2012. There was probably only four dogs from his dad's kennel. He had random dogs from all over. He had dogs from Lance Mackey, dogs from Jeff King, and he trained them totally separate to Mitch. So he did start from scratch, but he had that, you know, that childhood of picking up the poop and feeding the dogs. So he knew all that stuff. But then,
being a junior racer,
in 2012,
and he'd won some of the junior races and all that, and so he had it in his bones. So I'm interested in how you develop the dogs, because the dogs are the real. I mean, the people are athletes, but the dogs are the super athletes here, and you have to breed them, and you have to figure out which dogs you're going to breed to get the puppies, and you've got to pick the puppies and figure out which are the best ones, and it's a generation to generation thing, right? So the top kennels are kennels where they have had a series of successful dogs. Do you guys get involved in that at all, Christian, or is that part of your what you do and sort of looking at dogs, evaluating them, figuring out which ones to breed and which ones to make team members and stuff?
Definitely. This past summer, we bred a lot of dogs out of a dog called Reef, and he was only a two-year-old last year, and I trained him for his yearling year and his two-year-old year, and he was going to run in my race last year for Iditarod, but 2 days before the race, Dallas had an injury, so Dallas took him being my best dog, took him into his team, and he ended up being in this one of the seven dogs that won. So he was sort of a superstar at 2 years old. And that dog, I don't know, he got lucky all summer pretty much. And it was basically me telling Dallas, this dog is really good. He's shining in my team. I shouldn't have told him that because Dallas ended up with him.
So you lost him. Yeah, that's no good. So when you take a dog like that and you breed him, it gets lucky, as you say. I don't know if they... you know, they there's no nightclub involved or anything, right? They could go straight to where they're going. But what percentage of the pups are going to be just as good? Or is it like just, is it unknowable?
It has a lot to do with the genetics, you're right. So if you're breeding a good male that has performed, hopefully his parents were good breeding. And Reef's parents, one of them was Peyton, who's Mitch's famous dog, who's, you know, a superstar for Mitch. So then Reef is now a superstar for Dallas. And Reef's pups, hopefully, are going to be superstars as well, as if the mum was a good breeder. And also with the training. Genetics is a big part, but I think it's all about conditioning and all about training. You can't just have a good puppy and go, okay, this dog, its parents were the best. It's going to be the best, you know? You need to condition it and train it appropriately. And if it's getting injured, maybe, I don't know, give it a few weeks off and start again. Break it down, build it up. You can't just pretend it's going to be the best dog in the yard because its parents were great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've seen it where about maybe one, two puppies a litter, just after a few years, just don't cut it. But usually if it's a good set breeding, the whole litter can really be built up and trained well.
And how do you, Liz, how do you sort of see that? How do you sort of pick up the knowledge of how good this dog is?
A lot of running short miles with puppy teams. We got yearlings right now that I'm helping to train, and I was running them at 6 months old last year at the end of the season, and you kind of know right away. Some dogs just love it, and you can see it. It's natural. Other dogs, we have some that are 2 years old that still seem like they have no idea what they're doing, but when they do for that couple miles, it's like, all right, there's potential. We can keep working with these guys. Maybe they'll calm down in a year. It's just a lot of watching their gaits and their attitudes and, you know, how they present themselves on the run and with other dogs.
I'm interested in from all of you guys, when you're evaluating a dog and determining whether it could be, you know, one of these champions, or maybe you're looking at a champion, is it the physical capability of the dog? In other words, how long and well it can run, or is it more the temperament and intelligence of the dog that's the key factor?
Yes.
But, okay.
Really, a lot of it. What we're looking for in the dogs is what they is if they're enjoying themselves, if they're having fun, if they come back into the yard after a long run and they're barking and screaming and ready to go again, and also if when we're out on the run, if they're constantly pulling, if they're leaning into their harness and their tug line, the line that's attached to the gang line, if that's always tight, then that's a sign that these guys are really working hard and they're good to go. If you see a dog that comes back into the yard and it's just exhausted, and well, first of all, you probably ran them too hard or too long, and they need to have less miles. But a lot of the time, you're just looking to see which of the dogs you can run the way that you need to run Iditarod or any other race, and they'll come back and want to do it more. You'll have some dogs that won't be your most intelligent dogs. They won't be the dogs that are running up front. the lead dogs and all that. But they'll come back into the yard screaming to go every single time, and those are going to be powerful dogs. They'll be an asset for your team. And then you'll have other dogs that you can tell, you give them a G command or a haw command, and they pop right to it. They go right for G and left for haw, and every single time without hesitation, you know those are your smart dogs. So it's a combination of the intelligence, it's a combination of the strength, of the conditioning. But you have to be careful about how you run the dogs. You can't run them too hard, you can't run them too long, because then it becomes not fun for them. And you can't make a sled dog. You can't make a sled dog pull you. The sled dog has to want to go.
Yeah. As many mushers have learned to their despair, right, when the team stopped. So, I'm curious about. I mean, when we think about human athletes, there's such a huge range of physical ability. When I think about dogs, it seems like they seem much more similar to me. But maybe that's just because I don't have that much experience with them. What do you think, Christian, in terms of like the difference of just physical ability between the dogs as opposed to the sort of the attitude and the intelligence?
In our kennel, what we look for is, as Philip said, if a dog's tired or not, it doesn't matter if he's stupid, it doesn't matter if he's barking or whatever. If he's tired when you come home, we will obviously give him time off. What we're looking for is a dog that is always got energy, always happy, always eating. Eating's the biggest thing, and when they're not tired, they will eat. If they're tired, they won't eat. So, yeah, you want an energetic dog that when you get back is going to run around, is going to eat his food as fast as he can because he's happy. And those dogs, you can train. You can train them hard because they're not getting tired. And you can push them to the limits, and they're still going to eat. And if they don't eat, your team's going to crumple. Your dog team, yeah, they're just not going to have energy. They're not going to be able to eat, and it's just sort of snowballs, and the effect ends up your team will stop.
Right.
And start with your weakest dog, he'll stop eating, and if you keep pushing, it's just going to keep going. So, yeah, when we're training and when we're looking at younger dogs, we're always looking at who's not getting tired and who's eating.
So if you're out there in a race and the dogs don't want to eat, it means that you need to spend more time resting, essentially.
Yes and no. If you're racing and you don't know how to train a team, you should have trained them the way you're going to race. You don't you don't go out there and go, okay, I've trained 40-mile runs, let's do 70s, because your team's going to crumple. So you should be training the same way you're going to race. And by training that way, you should know that they're still eating on that speed on those mile runs. But a lot of people, you know, they get all excited and they go 13 miles an hour up to Yentna, and their team's tired by the time they get there, when really you've been training at 8.5 miles the whole season.
Yeah, interesting. So the race strategy has always seemed to me, it's what the media always talks about, but it's always seemed to me to be so much less important than the conditioning and preparation of the musher and and especially the dogs. That like strong dogs usually win. I mean, maybe done that last 5 miles strategy is super important, but I mean, and what you guys are doing is building strong dogs, and that's sort of the heart of the sport. Would you agree, Philip?
I would definitely say that we're spending this entire time just making sure our dogs are as conditioned, as ready for whatever we can throw at them as possible.
Mm-hmm. And you better enjoy that.
Oh yeah, it's great. I mean, it's hard on you, it's hard on the dogs, but it's not. I mean, you get to be amazed at what these dogs can accomplish. You look at a tiny little 40-pound dog and say, "Oh, that dog's just too small," and then you see them at the end of the season and they're just. I mean, you put them on the line by themselves and they're pulling your sled and you're trying to pop your snow hook free, and you're like, "Holy cow, where did this dog come from?" And it's just, you can really see from the beginning of the season to the end of the season how strong these dogs can get.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen, I mean, you can have a strategy for the race all you want, talk about it. I talked with Didi about it last year, and things happen on the race from what I've heard and what I saw with Didi last year.
Yeah.
And you really have to rely on the fact that you have the dogs ready to handle anything that comes up, and you got to train like that too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Philip, you are going to be racing the Iditarod with a group of borrowed dogs.
Yes.
They're not yours.
Right.
But you've developed a relationship with these dogs. I mean, you know sort of who they are as individuals, or is there a little bit of a, crapshoot there as to
definitely not a crapshoot. At this point, these dogs, I've been training the same set of dogs since the beginning of the season. Most of the dogs I've been training for two seasons. However, the first race I actually ran with these guys was the Testamina 200 2 years ago, and the first time I'd ever run them was up to the starting line of the Testamina 200.
Oh, wow.
And so that was a bit of a crapshoot, but the dogs, Justin had done a great job training the dogs, and they listened to me. And we got through it. That was one of my qualifiers for Iditarod. And so, but the dogs know me very well, and I know them. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing that you can, one of the most important things that you can do as a musher is make sure you know everything about your dogs on the race, so that if anything changes, you're on it right away, and you can keep an eye out for those dogs. The dogs are our paramount responsibility. We want to make sure that they are okay.
Mm-hmm. So, Christian, the dogs you're going to be racing, sounds like there could be some last-minute swaps, but you're going to be really familiar with these dogs by the time you get to the starting line, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I've worked with them a lot last year when they were yearlings, and then a lot this year coming up. And also I've worked with all the older guys that will be coming back down. They're not, I say old, I mean 5 or 4 years old, and the only reason they're getting knocked out of Dallas's team is because he's got younger dogs, 3-year-olds, that are superstars. They're not aging out. They're not veterans. It's just they're not at that level. They can't do the same pace anymore. Or they could. It's just they're not as good as the younger dogs. So, yeah, I'll know the older guys. I'll know all the new guys, and I've worked with them. Me and Noah, I've got quite a few dogs to work with this season, I think close to 30, so it's hard to run them by myself doing the same amount of runs. So Noah's training them as well, and he's going to be running them in the qualifying races for the Iditarod this year as well. So that puts extra miles that I don't need to run. I'll learn them intimately. I'll leader train with all the guys I know that aren't leaders, and the guys that are leaders, I'll let them rest in the back of the team and they can just hang out. You know, I already know they can lead.
I'm interested, Christian, do you hope to own a kennel do you have a long-term goal, or are you just sort of taking it year to year?
Being Australian, it's very hard. We don't really have any snow at home. I don't think so. I think this is the last year. I know this is the last year I'll be coming up here.
Wow. Well, good luck. Good luck. We'll be watching you. We'll be watching you and seeing how you do. And I want to, Liz, you want to be a vet. You don't want to be a big time musher.
No. Yeah, I want to be a vet. I loved working with animals, and sled dogs have always amazed me since I learned about them, their physiology, their capabilities to do the Iditarod. That's what's always intrigued me. And I just want to keep learning more about them and be able to improve the health of the dogs, the stamina of the dogs, and keep the race.
Do you see yourself racing to Nome sometime?
I'd like to do it sometime,
yeah.
But one dream at a time.
How could you not, right,
yeah,
after all of this work? Well, you guys have been really interesting, and I wish luck to you, and I'm sure our listeners are going to be following Christian and Philip on the trail as the Iditarod gets started. I've had three guests today, and thanks to all of them. Christian Turner, who's with the CV Kennel. Thanks, Christian.
Thanks for having me.
And Philip Walters in the studio. He's going to run the Iditarod for the first time this year, and he teaches middle school here in Anchorage. Thanks for being with us, Philip.
It was my pleasure.
And Liz Millman, who's with the Didi Jonro Kennel. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
So next week, we're going to have a show about making your own equipment, making your own skis, Alaskans make all kinds of stuff, and it's one of the really neat things about our outdoor community is that we're inventors and we figure out how to meet our own challenges. So tune in for that next week. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.